Welcome to Sacred Realms, a podcast where two rabbis discuss science fiction and fantasy through a Jewish lens. This episode is From Sarah to Sarah Connor, Heroines in Tanakh, Sci-Fi, and Fantasy. I am Rabbi Andrew Pepperstone, here again with my remarkably clever colleague, Rabbi Lindsay Pollack.
Hi. Insert clever response here.
That was good.
That's all I can come up with right now.
That was a clever response. All right. So for our 12th episode, we're going to answer the question of the month, talk about what we've been watching or reading lately, and then turn to our main topic, From Sarah to Sarah Connor, Heroines in Tanakh, Sci-Fi, and Fantasy, and then to our final segment, From the Geniza, where we dust off some of our favorites from the past. So, our question of the month, what is your favorite heroine from sci-fi or fantasy?
So, for me, the first one that came to mind is classic favorite Daenerys Targaryen from the Game of Thrones series, who I would say, right as I said it, I thought, you know, it's actually not so obvious. Is she a heroine? She's certainly a more complex character than I think we often think of, you know, like a classic hero or heroine. With her story throughout most of the seasons of the show, we're sympathetic to her and want her to succeed. She's, you know, she is kind of in an oppressed situation. She manages to get her way out of it, becomes a leader who at least seems to be guided by values, compassion for those who are oppressed and freeing them, utilizing her dragons, of course, to make this happen. But you see over time, she starts to become a little bit more brutal in her tactics, justifying her actions through like her ideological lens of, you know, both being justified because of her position as the true heir of the Targaryen dynasty and having a right to rule not only the places that she's taken over but Westeros as well, and also, you know, her role as liberator seems to give her, in her mind, justification to kind of do things through any means necessary, which ultimately leads to her downfall. But she's a badass character, and I frequently, you know, kind of channel in my mind, you know, the image of Daenerys with just like, you know, fire blazing behind her from the dragons, you know, those moments when you need to, you know, kind of like muster your most powerful fiery energy. It's a good one that I turn to.
It is good. Well, as I listen to that, I wonder, is she a protagonist in the Moses type where gets to a certain point and then can go no further? Like if we're to like typify her as a kind of like a leader protagonist, is she in the Mosaic mold where Moses had his own reason he could not go further, and she has her why she gets as far as she does for Westeros, and then for her reason can go no further? Or is there another like biblical or rabbinic type that she matches for you?
It's an interesting question. I mean, I think, like, I understand what you're saying, but I think, like, the Moses type feels a little different to me because other than mistakes that he certainly makes, for the most part, he, you know, he doesn't become corrupt. That's not, like, the reason that he isn't allowed into the land. There may be a lot of really good reasons why he needs to transfer leadership to someone else, and that makes sense. And he doesn't become, you know, violent towards the end. And, you know, his knowledge that he's not going to make it doesn't seem to change him into someone else. Whereas with her, you really see this, you know, getting increasingly desperate towards the end. You know, I don't know. I kind of would, the thing that came to mind for me in sort of like the anti-hero kind of, or heroes that fall, maybe more of a Samson type character, right? Not entirely, because he's got problems like all throughout, but in the end, you know, he like pulls down the structure around him and is crushed, which I kind of feel like feels parallel to what Daenerys does. She doesn't kill herself, but she sort of like self-destructs.
She kind of brings it all crumbling down, but that's not what ends her. That's Jon Snow. Spoilers.
Spoiler alert. Okay, what about you?
For me, I initially went, of course, to my default of Star Wars and then pivoted to actually another protagonist who I think is one of like the best female protagonists in it, certainly in a sci-fi movie, which is Ripley from specifically Aliens, even though she was an alien. I recently watched a deep dive analysis of the movie Aliens on a YouTube channel called The Deep Dive with Eric Voss, which is
Right, you were
a little
talking
bit,
about that
big fan of his
not too
work.
long ago.
He's a literary cinemaphile who does great stuff. And just like brought out, Ripley as like in the first movie, the unexpected protagonist. She's kind of like on the side till mid-film, and you realize, oh, she's actually our main character, kind of like a subversion of that expectation. And then she's front and center in the second one when they go back out there to look into a colony that they've lost touch with. And indeed, there are the xenomorphs all over. And you learn at the beginning of the film that in the years since she basically ended the first film and was in space in hibernation and gets back to Earth, that her daughter has grown up, become elderly, and died. So she is a mother bereft of daughter. And then when she gets to this other world, they come across a young girl nicknamed Newt and becomes her mother figure and is also a warrior and a fighter and a strategic thinker in the group. And the big climactic battle is between her, a mother protecting Newt and the remaining other Marines, up against the alien queen, who is merely protecting her own eggs as well. So it's really this battle of mother versus mother in an epic battle where she's wearing this mechanized power suit, which she had to learn just to kind of get a job to make ends meet back on Earth. And so she uses that to battle this very, very large xenomorphic mother alien in the battle. I think it's a great protagonist. Really, I mean, Sigourney Weaver makes the role iconic, and that's a favorite among many others.
And for those listening, you can drop us an email with your answer to this month's question at sacredrealmspodcast@gmail.com. So, what have you been watching or reading lately?
Been watching the Star Wars series Bad Batch Season 3 on Disney Plus, which is the story of this squad of misfit clone soldiers in the first year or two of the Empire. A lot of this season is focused around filling in the gaps to get us to how Palpatine actually returned from his death at the end of Return of the Jedi, which is, of course, a very advanced cloning program. And I will not spoil anything, but we kind of like figure out how he actually managed to come back with a Force-sensitive clone, because in the Star Wars universe, clones can't take midichlorians, which are that symbiotic life form that connects people to the Force. Like, clones can't do it, but they figure out how to do it. So that's been good. It's very well done. It's not for children. And it kind of gets into like one of the themes we've talked about, which is the line between ethical and unethical pursuits, specifically in science. How far should humanity go before it crosses the line into where humanity should not go and begins playing with the realms with which they should not be messing? So think about like the Tower of Babylon as would be the archetypal story about where humanity breaches into God's domain and God smacks it down. So it kind
Well,
of gets
yeah,
me.
that and, Garden of Eden, Tree of Knowledge.
What fruit should we not eat? What should we not build to get into the appropriate territory? So it kind of gets into that. Avatar, The Last Airbender live action, the whole series dropped. Didn't expect that. They jumped the whole thing in one batch of 8 episodes. Have you watched that show? I can't remember.
The original one?
The
No, I
original one.
haven't. Because I saw that this one was released, and I was like, oh, what do I do? Do I need to like watch the animated one first? And then, because it's been kind of on my list for a while.
I would watch
or
the
what should I
live
do?
action one first and then watch the animated one, because the animated one is still, in my mind, the superior expression of the story.
Okay.
It looks so good. The world looks good. The bending looks really good. I think the casting is
In the
good.
new one?
In the new one, the casting is good. The acting is good. There's some very beautiful moments where I felt emotionally tugged in the right ways, because there's some very touching storylines between people and their relationships. So it certainly has a lot of that. My only quibble is with some of the character portrayals and how they shifted things from, 20 odd episodes into 8 longer episodes, having to cut, certain things. But, in particular to our topic this month, Katara, who is the primary female protagonist, is part of the team who goes with Aang, who is the Avatar, to fight to restore world justice. Her portrayal is a little smoother, blander, not as many interesting rough edges. I will still watch the rest because why not? And but I still prefer the original. And then I'm gonna save one thing that's actually more of like a what I've been watching, but it's really from the Geniza, which is the show Fringe. So I'll come back to that later on. But I have been watching Fringe. My brother told me to watch it, so I'm watching it. I've been watching it at a reasonable pace, and it's from 2008. It stars John Noble, who played the steward of Gondor in the Lord of the Rings movies, whose name is Denethor, that actor. And he plays Walter Bishop in this. There's also a remarkable female protagonist, Olivia Dunham, who is the lead investigator in this fringe unit of the FBI. And she is worthy of coming back to think about, like, the portrayal of female protagonist. And I've also been watching the show Constellation on Apple TV, which is, I highly recommend that. It is this very sciencey science fiction show. You're on the ISS and you're following Joanna Eriksson, who is an astronaut from Sweden, who is up in space. And there's an experiment being done called the CAL. And something happens with the CAL. There's an accident, someone dies, and then she gets back to Earth eventually, and it's all a little bit weird. And I just watched the sixth episode this week, and last week they made you realize that you haven't been paying attention to the show. And now, if you go back and watch it all over again, you will see everything differently. And it's quite a delightful mind warp. Really good. Good science fiction. Apple's doing great on that. So what have you been watching and or reading lately?
So I thought maybe I would finish before this episode, because last time I had talked about the comic series Paper Girls, which I'm still kind of working my way through. I think my first impression had been that it was, as some of the reviews of it originally had said, kind of like it's like Stranger Things, similar era. They start in the 19, weird happenings that these young people are trying to figure out. But at least plot-wise, it's very different to me, and it's very focused on time traveling, and you're trying to kind of figure out what's going on as they move through portals that bring them into different points in time, where there are these, like, there's this ongoing conflict between people in two different times in the future, who, like, one of whom it turns out, like, this is what has emerged over the course of what I've been reading, a group that, once they discover time travel, determines that actually what we should be doing is going back in time and intervening in order to make things better, because why wouldn't you want things to be better? Where there's another group who has encountered that group doing their time traveling thing, disagrees with it, and wants to stop them by any means necessary. So there's like these two different groups from two different points in the future sort of chasing each other through time, that the young protagonists, female protagonists, fits well with our theme, are encountering along the way. So we'll see what happens. Great illustration, very creative in how they kind of imagine possible futures, right? How language evolves. So they kind of have almost like, you know, the people in the future are speaking a dialect of English that's sort of like internet speak inflected, and you can kind of interpret it, but it's sort of hard, and there's different generations who have to kind of translate. Anyway, it's like I enjoy things like that, where it's like sort of the imagining, well, what is the future if we continue along in our current track going to look like, in terms of like just sort of cultural shifts like that. And then, but the other thing that I had for some reason neglected to mention last time, or maybe had watched kind of between recording sessions, was the movie Wonka, which I absolutely loved as a fan of the 1970s Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory movie with Gene Wilder. I really enjoyed this. It's a great prequel starring Timothée Chalamet in the title role. They wrote a lot of new songs for this movie, and there's a lot of nice nods to music from the original one, Pure Imagination. They incorporate that song, but you know, change some of the lyrics a little bit to make it, you know, new for this, as well as added some new songs. And to me, you know, the mark of a successful musical is, are you humming the songs or remembering some of the songs after you leave the movie? And in that case, it was yes. I went with my kids, and you know, we immediately found the soundtrack and we were listening to it, and my son was very enthusiastic about learning all of the words for Pure Imagination, among other things. So I think it's a great movie. It's appropriate for kids of multiple ages. It was creative in kind of imagining Wonka's backstory in this city that, fictional city that kind of like a London Paris hybrid, maybe. But yeah, it's family appropriate. And also really fun for anyone who enjoys the original 1970s one, because there's a lot of nice, you know, cinematic nods to that as well, and like same costuming or similar costuming, explaining how he got his start as a chocolate maker.
Yeah, oh, I grew up with that movie so much. We had it on VHS and we watched it over and over again. We used to watch the scene where Grandpa Joe gets out of bed and dances and sings the song I've Got a Golden Ticket. We used to watch it in reverse and then like watch it like fast forwarded, but like a little bit, and it's even funnier. And you watch it back. I saw Dune Part Two and he's having a good year. He's been Willy Wonka and Paul Atreides. That's a pretty good year for iconic roles for anybody.
It was funny because when we came out of the movie, you know, we were confronted after watching Wonka, confronted with like the poster for Dune, which had not yet come out. And my son was like, "Hey, it's Willy Wonka." Yes, it is. It's the
Yes, he
same.
will be eating spice, not chocolate, and then it will still make him strange. Yeah, Dune 2 was epic. Have you seen part one?
No, I
Worth
need to.
watching.
I really want to.
Epic, really great adaptation of Herbert's classic novel. And you really do feel how much it inspired Star Wars, inspired George Lucas in terms of like a desert planet. And there is spice in the Star Wars universe. There are the spice mines of Kessel, which get mentioned and shown on screen. And even the Jedi mind trick comes from Dune. It's the Bene Gesserit's use of what they call like the voice. They can use their voice to make people do things. Very
Wow.
pre-Star Wars. In terms of like also like imagining where humanity will go, it's a similar thing. This is 10,000 years in the future, and humanity is all over the galaxy now, and they've advanced in so many ways. There's even like family houses where they've evolved, or not evolved, they've adapted to different planets' climates. Like the Harkonnens are in a world with a black sun. And they're all very pale. I don't know if they shave their hair or don't have hair, but none of them have hair, either culturally or genetically, not sure. Epic film, really, really good. And the portrayal of Shani, the main female protagonist, or one of the two main female protagonists, which there really are three, there's Jessica, mother, Shani, and then there's Aaliyah with Paul's sister, who is in this movie a little bit, but the way that Chani is portrayed, people were critiquing the shift from the book version to the film version, And they make her much more assertive, much more of an independent person with will versus like a subservient female. Because Paul, not as, it's been 70 years, Paul in the end basically marries the emperor's daughter, even though Chani is like, mate for life, as it were, or partner for life, as a political move. And in the book, it's kind of like, oh, whatever, he has to. In the movie, she is pissed, man. She does not take it lightly, despite Paul's reassurance that he loves her and loves her alone. So, on to our main topic. From Sarah to Sarah Connor, heroines in Tanakh, sci-fi, and fantasy. So, Lindsay, who are the heroines in Tanakh?
So we found many examples of them and also started talking about what exactly it is that makes someone a hero or a heroine as we were talking about the various different characters, like what are the qualities that someone needs in order to be in that archetype. So most of the female characters are in Tanakh, in the Hebrew Bible, are not named. Often the ones that are named are the ones that we would probably readily identify as being heroines. So if they are do have a name, right, they're essential to the plot and might be the main actors. We found that biblical heroines in particular often subvert the expectations of the society in which they live. The storylines that we identified are often rooted in social positions for women at the time. They might be working within or possibly subverting like the framework of their social roles to take actions, but they don't, usually completely strike out of the mold. So often these are narratives involving mothers regarding a child, usually a son. So one example of that is, well, first Sarah, as her title indicates, Sarah, the wife of Abraham. Whether she's a heroine or not, might be an interesting question, but she certainly is responsible in important ways for the continuing of Abraham's lineage through her actions. I would say Rivka, with her children, Jacob and Esau, is another example of this, a mother taking action within that framework. Maybe Hannah also with, although, right, I mean, her, she doesn't do anything maybe in as, well, I don't know. What do you think? I mean, her acts of resistance are praying and then speaking up against what Eli the priest tells her when he accuses her of being drunk as she's, mumbling prayers to herself.
Yeah, I think those are two excellent examples of subverting an expectation because Hannah is at Shiloh at the Mishkan, the tabernacle. You're supposed to be offering an animal, grain, oil, wine sacrifice, and then enjoying the celebratory meal from that with your family. She's not. So she kind of subverts that expectation. She's kind of like off on her own and her kind of communicating with God is done with this weird, looks like she's drunk private prayer, which, right, Eli thinks she's a drunkard. And then she challenges Eli with her reading of her behavior and calls him to the mat. And he backs off and he, offers her a blessing. And then Samuel is born, who is then the hero of his generation to a point. So yeah, and I think she is subversive in those ways.
She is subversive, right? But I feel like
But she a hero, she a heroine.
she a heroine, right? What makes somebody a heroine, right?
Right. Sarah being a heroine when she, takes steps to have a son with Abraham with Hagar, a surrogate mother, that does not go well. And then they have the miraculous birth of Isaac. And then when she kicks out Ishmael and Hagar from the household to keep them away from inheriting Abraham's, the rabbis frame Ishmael as the villain. He is Mitzahek. He's either acting like Isaac or treating Isaac in some immoral, unethical fashion and worthy of being kicked out. But the rabbis really come to Sarah's defense as heroine. Like, oh, yes, saving him from Ishmael's terrible adolescent behavior. I'm not sure that's the pshat reading of Ishmael and Hagar, but that certainly is the rabbinic reading of Ishmael.
They don't want there to be moral ambiguity with some of these stories. You know, you can make similar arguments about Rivka as well. I mean, she clearly is prioritizing one child over the other, working behind the scenes to ensure that Jacob is going to receive the blessing from Isaac. I mean, there's lots of different ways that we can interpret this story, of course, but, you know, we're told right at the outset with them that each of the parents has a preference for one of their children. So that's certain, you know, the kind of behavior attributes that we typically these days at least want to encourage or emulate. So these characters, right, even if they are heroic or do heroic things, are also complex human beings with, you know, moral failings, which is, I think, what makes the narratives of the Torah and then the rest of the Tanakh really interesting and compelling for us as readers, is that they're not just these overly simplistic stories.
If Sarah is the heroine of the protector of Isaac's inheritance of Abraham's line, and if Rebecca is the next one to do that, it's interesting, though, that you get such sympathetic stories about Ishmael and Esav after that. There's a lot of pathos around the son who is excluded from that lineage. Like Ishmael, he nearly dies, and the story is like filled with pathos for this mother who is wandering and this child who's near death, and God opens her eyes and there's the well and their lives are saved. And you really feel Hagar's pain. And Esav, you feel his, you know, he's a very emotional individual, and he has this loud, bitter crying at being denied his firstborn blessing. And you really feel for Esav. All the while, like, you're aware that Sarah and Rebecca are the ones who are keeping the line with certain sons. It's definitely nuanced. Like, you don't, Esav's not the villain. He's just not going to be part of Abraham's line in that sense.
Right. Although he later gets interpreted as being a villain as well, right? Being associated with Dome, and then later with, you know, Rome and all other kind of, you know, enemies of the Jewish people, in at least by the medieval period.
So they kind of flatten the narrative to make Esav the villain. In that sense,
So one other, like, mother story that stands out also as a heroine is Zipporah, Moses's wife, where Moses is attacked by this being when they're on their way back to Egypt, and she circumcises the sons, and it's then that she is able to save Moses's life that way. I mean, we don't even know, how does she know what to do, or that that's the issue in this situation? But she's the one who's taking action that Moses should have taken, but she's the one who does it. And so it's another kind of example, I think, with all of these, right? The women are the ones who have to ensure that things go the way that they're supposed to go. It's an example maybe of her taking an action that the male character, the patriarch or leader, should take, but does not. And often, there's a signal in some of these stories that to the audience that something unusual is going on, when the expected script in a patriarchal society would be that, you know, the male characters are kind of driving the plot, but when we have these more active women, that is kind of a clue, okay, there's something unique and special going on here for an audience at that time, right? So Sarah listening at the door, Rivka being really active and proactive about helping the camels and for Abraham's servant in this, you know, crazy feat of strength, and being very proactive in answering for herself that she's going to go with him in order to marry Isaac. And then Devorah and Yael, and women in the book of Judges, are a different kind of role. They're not primarily mothers or known to be mothers at all in their roles. But women in the book of Judges often are taking on positions of leadership and power, which some people, including Professor Amy Kalmanovsky at JTS and others that I've heard, make the argument that women being in power is supposed to be, according to the authors of Judges, a symptom of the problematic, chaotic nature of Israel during the period of the Judges, if it's written by authors who are very pro-monarchy. It's supposed to be an illustration of the ways in which things are flipped on their head, perhaps. Although the stories of Devorah and Yael, right, there's no criticism of them at all. They actually seem to be quite successful.
Right, and right, when they're put in the context of the Book of Judges, then it's like, oh, look, things are falling apart because, you know, things were going well, men would be doing these things, but in Judges context, where things were like sliding down the slope into increasing moral chaos, then they look like they're a symptom of the larger problem, right? But the story by itself, you would never get that. I see what you're saying.
Right. Well, I mean, it was the whole, even from the outset with Devorah's. So Devorah is a judge. She's the leader of the people, and her general Barak is supposed to, go out and lead the charge and battle. And he kind of, wimps out, and she essentially says to him, you're a woman is going to get the glory for this victory and not you. So I think embedded in that story, you're seeing that. I mean, the critique is coming from Devorah herself in that case, which is really interesting. And then you taking the action that she does to kill Sisera by luring him into the tent. So it's women are the ones who get the job done, as it were.
Yeah, the pattern that I'm seeing as you're going through Sarah, Rebecca, Zipporah, Devorah, and Yael is when men are blind or not stepping up to do what they should be doing, women see what needs to be done and they fill the void. But if Abraham really saw Hagar and Ishmael as Sarah did, he would have done the same thing, maybe. Or maybe Sarah just sees things differently than Abraham does, but God agrees with her. God tells Abraham, she's right. You have to send them away. I'll take care of them. Don't worry about it. And he sees Abraham is worried about both of them. And, you know, Isaac's literally blind. I don't think he's that blind, but Rebecca thinks he's blind and steps in. And then Zipporah, who knows what that story is about, clearly steps in because Moses is unable to do anything. And then same with Devorah and Yael. The men are unable to do what they're supposed to do, and women rise to the occasion and save the people in various ways. Is that their only role? Is this when men fail, women step up? There's no like women on their own in Tanakh who do their own thing. Is that the role of the heroine in the Tanakh? Is that what they're limited to?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, and I wonder how much of it is just based on what our interpretation is, right? Is it that the women are doing what the men should be doing? In some cases, clearly yes. In others, I mean, maybe it was always the case that the women were the ones who were going to be taking definitive action. Maybe you could read it that way.
And they do. Women do take definitive action time and time and time again.
Yeah, it's not necessarily that they're stepping up where the men fail, but that, they are a core part of the story. We sort of see that a little bit in the Exodus story. We were talking about Miriam, other model of women's leadership, of heroism, all of the different ways from the beginning that she saves Moses's life, she's called a prophet. She continues to play a really active role throughout the narrative until her death, as she's recognized as being a leader. Some of the midrash is really, I think, what fills in the idea that the men were not doing what they were supposed to be doing, and the women are the ones who kind of step in when they're talking about the ways in which, the men, out of fear because of the decree of Pharaoh to kill all of the boys, that they were declining to participate in procreation, and that it was the women that essentially ensured the continuity of the Jewish people by, doing things to kind of continue to entice the men. They were giving birth to six children at a time, according to the Midrash, like all of those kinds of things. So it's like, it's sort of interesting because it's like, I wonder, is it that like this paradigm of when the men, aren't acting, the women step up becomes like so core that when the rabbis don't see it in the text, directly in the text of the Tanakh itself, they still feel like, okay, we got to add this in there.
Right. Is that the lens through which they look at every narrative where a woman acts definitively? Oh, it must have been because the man was not acting as he should have. The midwives, I would say, are heroic.
in
Definitely.
Shifrin, Pua, and the rabbis call them sometimes Yocheved and Miriam, mother and daughter, and also as Yocheved and Elisheva, as mother-in-law and daughter-in-law, Elisheva being Aaron's wife. But regardless, they defy Pharaoh's decree to kill
Right.
the infants with a bald-faced lie and are rewarded with it. So they definitely are putting their lives on the line. So we assume are often viewed as heroic.
Yeah. Right. A couple of others that seem sort of similar to me in that way, because we're not even sure based on how you read those verses, whether the midwives are themselves Hebrews or whether they're Egyptians. Some other examples of heroines that may not have been Jewish, Rahav in the book of Joshua, who is also kind of from this. She's in another sort of prototypical female role. Many of the others are mothers, although not exclusively, but Rahab is a prostitute, and she, for her own reasons, we don't exactly know, decides to aid Joshua and the Israelites in conquering the city.
In the narrative, when she meets them, the two spies, she tells them that she's heard about what God did and kind of gives the impression that she's going to switch sides and therefore they should save her and her family, that she will side with Israel against Canaan in the looming war. I think, what do you think? Is that implied in what she says? I kind of got that implication in how she describes, why she's going to help them.
Maybe it's totally just self-interested, right? You're
Could
like,
just be
okay,
self-interest. Yes.
let's see. I heard about God. God seems pretty powerful. I think you guys are gonna win, so I'm just gonna go over here and be on the winning
You
side.
know, I'm so influenced by the rabbinic reading. I got to remember to separate out the two, the pshat from the rabbinic drash. Got to keep those two in parallel universes. But she is a heroine. She does save the spies, and that reconnaissance does lead to the first major victory. So she is essential, and not filling in where a man would have failed, for sure. She's doing her own thing.
Her own thing. I mean, kind of back into the woman filling in where a man failed kind of narrative, but also linking to Rahav and like the woman as prostitute as being one of the primary roles. We of course have the story of Jehuda and Tamar, his daughter-in-law. That's a clear case where the men in the family are not doing what they're supposed to be doing. After his first two sons die, they decline to marry the third son to her. She goes back to her father's house and is kind of waiting around for younger son to grow up, watches the clock ticking, decides, okay, clearly they're not going to do this. So then she creates her own plan, which is to go where they are going, where Judah is going to be going for the shearing, I believe.
Yeah, Sheep Con. I call it Sheep Con.
Sheep con.
Sheep Con. Yep. She gets in cosplay as a prostitute.
And she goes and sits on the side of the road, as you do. He doesn't recognize her. She takes his staff and cord as collateral. And he's gonna go back and send a servant to send a goat or sheep as payment, because that's what you do. Like, hey, is there a prostitute here? And they're like, nope, I haven't seen one. Turns out Tamar, everybody realizes she's pregnant. They're gonna take her out and stone her, and then she shows up with his identifying objects to call him out in public, and he says, oh yeah, you're right. So it all works out in the end, but she has to sort of resort to these both deception and having to engage in one of the roles available to women to be able to exercise agency, which is prostitution.
The second brother, named Onan, for whom Onanism is named,
Yes.
but his sin is that he does not do right by his brother. He is a self-centered individual who does not want to have his child inherit his brother's line. And then Shelah, the third one, he's just a kid, apparently. But she does send Judah the cord and seal through a messenger, which does save him the public embarrassment, so it seems. And then he quickly could really admits that she was right and he was wrong. He understands everything in that moment, and then Tamar is not killed immediately, which is very good, or not killed at all.
What's her investment in this? Because, as
Yeah.
you said, her actions are a very clear example in this case of doing the thing that the men were supposed to do, right?
Right, to make her a mother.
Right, to make her a mother, but
for the purpose of continuing the male line. What does she get out of it other than, like, is this, really the only option available to you to sustain yourself and have, social standing in society?
And then further down that lineage, we have Ruth,
Yeah.
who is another heroine whose superpower is kindness. She's a Moabite. She goes with her mother-in-law after her husband and father-in-law die, along with her other brother-in-law and her sister-in-law, who goes back home, follows Naomi back to Bethlehem, but now that a famine has passed. And basically, she is the one who goes out and gleans in the fields for her and her mother-in-law, who are extraordinarily poor. They're like the most marginalized people you can imagine. She is a foreigner. She is a widow. She is an orphan, and she is poor. She is very marginal. And her kindness for Naomi is what, I guess, draws Boaz to marry her and redeem the family from its poverty and to take back their land from whoever had bought it
To some
in the
extent,
past.
yes. And then there's also, the Naomi's tricky plan that she hatches of sending Ruth to the threshing floor where he's going to be sleeping and,
Yes.
positioning herself.
Oh yeah, Naomi knows what's up. Naomi knows exactly who to go to, where to go, when to go, what do this, don't do that. Yeah, oh yeah. She definitely is. Yeah, she's very helpful. I never thought it was tricky before. That's interesting.
I mean, it's like they don't, instead of saying, hey, Boaz, why don't you marry Ruth? They're like, well, let's do this whole thing where we're going to go by night, put her in a sexually compromising position, or I don't know, exact, it's hard to interpret exactly what's
Well, that's
going
why
on.
let nobody see you. It certainly is.
But it's like she's still, why do that as opposed to just
Overtly doing it?
overtly
That's a great
asking?
question.
There's something that needs to be sort of hidden, or like a sense that if you did it overtly, like that it wouldn't work or something. Like why is that the case?
I'd say that her heroine nature for me comes from her kindness and this mother-in-law, daughter-in-law relationship, which doesn't really even exist. Like they actually have no obligation to each other than how they feel towards each other. Like Ruth shouldn't have gone. It's really very foolish for her to go to this place where she is totally disadvantaged to help out her mother-in-law, who is also severely disadvantaged in that society at that time. Right. It's always more nuanced for sure.
The things that becomes Ruth's sort of claim to fame in both later in the Tanakh. She tells us at the end of the Book of Ruth that she is the ancestor of King David. So starting out as a Moabite and then eventually becoming one of the progenitors of the monarchy, which is really interesting in and of itself. And she is identified by the rabbis as being kind of the prototype for conversion or statement to Naomi, where you go, I will go, where you lodge, I will lodge, your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. So she is heroic in a number of different ways, I think.
Yeah.
And of course, we cannot forget to mention Esther, because
Woohoo, Esther.
you celebrate Purim as of the time of this recording.
Yeah, strange heroine too. Definitely a strange heroine. Young girl whisked into the king's harem because he needs a new queen, which is a very bizarre, weird thing to do in ancient Persia. And she just stays in the castle until Mordecai realizes that she is the only one who can actually save them from the plot of the evil Haman. And then she risks her life, goes to the king unannounced or uninvited, and reveals the plot. Definitely an unconventional heroine. Puts her life on the line, could have been executed in a heartbeat. We certainly see Haman gets executed for almost nothing. In the end, he does not get killed for his plot. He gets killed because the king thinks he's hitting on the queen. Yeah, so that's which is quite funny.
Yeah.
Esther totally could have been killed if the king had been in a bad mood that day. Absolutely.
Right, because of his sort of, fickleness.
Yeah.
Another thing that's interesting about Esther too is that she's somewhat reluctant, right? She only does this at Mordecai's urging.
Yeah.
So that makes her different from a lot of the other biblical heroines that we've been talking about, or all of them really, where they are all taking action for their own reasons or own motivations, even if it is something that will benefit others or ultimately benefit like the male line. In this case, I mean, the Book of Esther is just unusual in a lot of ways,
Yes.
but so it's maybe unsurprising that the heroine of the story would also be unusual and kind of a departure from a lot of the other biblical narratives. But she has to be kind of, you know, told to do it by Mordecai. Otherwise, if left to her own devices, she might have just, you know, kept her head down and gone about doing what you do.
Right, but it's Mordecai is saying that if you keep your head down, you're still not going to survive this. Like, you're not immune in the palace from what is going to happen. And that's her motivation. That and his optimism, who knows? Maybe this is why you've become the queen, is to do just this. And those two things motivate her. That she's not immune and that she has a unique position to save everybody. Then it's definitive action. You know, we'll do the fast, then I'll go to the king.
The degree of dialogue back and forth makes it so different from other biblical narratives.
Yeah, I'm actually teaching on Esther chapter 4 on Shabbat, and I'm writing a big sermon about it right now. So I'm very deeply into Esther chapter 4 in particular as a model of pursuing justice. It's actually a shockingly good model, which is a different topic, but I've been like really reading like this pivotal chapter. Because if not for this extensive dialogue through messengers, then the whole story unravels. Like if she was unconvinced, it would all fall apart. This is kind of like the common mold of the heroine in the Tanakh, with notable exceptions and subversions of it. What do we see with like, do we see similar patterns of heroines in sci-fi and fantasy? Are there other expectations that are at play here? Is it always like, are we always surprised to see a woman as a heroine? Is it always like a subversion of expectation?
Yeah, that was interesting. I mean, as we were talking to we and trying to identify examples of heroines, you know, we sometimes were finding, oh, you can be a heroine without necessarily being the protagonist of the story.
Elle is heroine, but not the main protagonist. She's this sidebar or this happening on the side surprise heroine. No one sees her coming, as it were. Well, Devorah does, but nobody else does. Sisera does not see her coming. If he does, he wouldn't have gone into her tent.
Yeah, I mean, thinking about examples of heroines in sci-fi and fantasy, that interest is an interesting question. Do they always subvert something, or is it just that our perception is that they are subversive just by the virtue of being female
Right. I think
characters?
that's still my bias, just the story that I was raised with. Having a female as the central protagonist or the main heroine is still not what the norm that I came out of it with as a, from childhood. You've got in Star Wars Luke, Han, and Leia, but it's really about Luke, and Leia is secondary. Even though she is surprising and subversive, you know, they rescue her, but then she rescues them within seconds. Like she's like, you know, yes, she's out of her jail cell. But then they have no idea how to actually get out from the attack of the stormtroopers in the jail cell, and she gets them out of that pickle. And then they end up in the garbage compactor, you know, which then the droids help them out of that. There's no one person saving everybody, it's always shifting around. Yeah, I guess that, but I still have that implicit bias, if I'm honest with myself.
I think that that's just a norm, an expected result of seeing, right, the vast majority still of sci-fi and fantasy productions, at least for TV and film, until fairly recently had male protagonists.
Yep.
That's the norm that we're used to seeing, and that someone had to make an active decision in most cases to, oh, I'm going to make the main character or the person who saves the day be female. And that just reads as subversive because it is a departure from what has been the norm. Although we have kind of gotten into, I mean, I'm not as well versed in all of these, but particularly with young adults, fiction and series that are for film and TV that are based on them, there have been a lot of female protagonists. Katniss Everdeen in The Hunger Games is a great example of this, for example.
Absolutely. There's been a lot of progress made in excellent writing with female protagonist, where it is just simply that's who it is, no subversion of expectation. Yeah, I've watched the series, both seasons of The Wheel of Time, and there's clearly one primary protagonist, but he is balanced out by the whole ensemble, the whole core ensemble of the friends of the heroes, who are each protagonist in their own ways, in their own side stories. And you have like the main, what do they call themselves? The wielders of magic. What do they call?
Aes Sedai.
The Aes Sedai, who are basically wizards or elemental based magic wielders. Right. And if men use that power, it'll drive them mad. It is forbidden. One of my favorite authors, Terry Pratchett, has many female protagonists among his many protagonists, but one in particular, which is from one of the last series he wrote as part of the Discworld mega series, is the Tiffany Aching series, which are five books about a young witch whose grandmother was the local witch who then dies, and then she becomes the local witch for her area. Her five book series within the Discworld series, she's an outstanding protagonist who you see her grow up every year as she kind of like moves from like the 14 to 18 years old, growing into her role as the witch in her re and which is not at all what almost any other sci-fi property calls a witch. It's Pratchett's own unique take on a witch, who is basically a person who knows how to use magic and often uses restraint, and then gets done what needs to get done in the area in which they operate. And she has older mentors who are Pratchett's classic witch protagonists who were in other various books of his. But I think her arc and her books are outstanding for any age. They're really, really good.
So those are some fantasy example, or would you say it's sci-fi? Is this
Sci-fi, recently in Dune, Chani, sort of the female lead of the Dune series. Notably, they've changed her character from the novel to the most recent adaptation. When Paul politically says to the Emperor, "I'm going to marry your daughter for political reasons," Chani in the book accepts this as political reality. But in the movie adaptation with Zendaya, she is pissed. And so I think it'll make the third film, Dune Messiah, far more interesting with a lot more narrative tension with a much stronger female protagonist in Chani than the novels. I've been watching Fringe, I'll talk about in the Geniza. And the lead is Agent Olivia Dunham. I mean, she is a protagonist, no two ways about it. She's the main character of the whole thing. It's all about her, and she is certainly she's not there because she is a mother of somebody, nor because she is a spouse of somebody. She is simply Olivia Dunham, FBI agent, who gets drawn into this weird world of strange science and does her own thing because of her own internal qualities and her own remarkable abilities. She certainly is not anything like a biblical heroine in terms of those expectations. Like, it is complete just there she is. She is the main character.
It's interesting, I was thinking about like one of the questions that we were asking is like, are there distinctions between heroes and heroines in terms of their characteristics or qualities in all of these sci-fi and fantasy works? We've talked about the ways in which, okay, to what degree is having a female heroine or just a heroine subversive just by its very nature? I mean, and there's like a couple of different ways that we see things playing out, right? There's the stories or properties where the characters are female to begin with, and then there's sometimes these rewrites that go on. You were talking a little bit about that with Dune, with rewriting the Chani character to be a little bit more assertive. A lot of the superhero stuff, right? They made Captain Marvel in newer iterations, a woman instead of a man. So it'll be interesting to see how this continues to develop, if there are more series, movies, TV that feature female character. I would say, in looking at what the commonalities are in a lot of these stories, you know, whether the main character is female or male, they often follow this arc of, right, the young person kind of on the fringe of society who gets identified or tapped to, you know, be the hero or heroine in some kind of way. So like almost everything seems to kind of follow paradigm.
The hero's journey paradigm.
Yeah. As new stories are being written where we're putting women in those roles, it doesn't really change that arc, which I think is a contrast from what we see in the Tanakh, where women are operating primarily within a set of socially prescribed roles, and that's where their heroism takes place.
Right. They subvert the norms to which they are subjected in surprising ways, but ultimately stay within those prescribed roles.
So that actually, you know, makes me think about this, right? This seems like a question that in many ways parallels the various waves of feminism, right? Like second wave feminism was all about, all right, women doing the same things that men do. So we see this with the heroic plot lines. Okay, we're just gonna have a female character who follows the same kind of arc with the hero's journey that we're accustomed to seeing in the Western literary canon. But the only difference is she's a girl or she's a woman. So what might it look like?
Oh, to your point, by the way. So the Karate Kid movies, there was Karate Kid 1, 2, and 3, and then they made one called The Next Karate Kid. With that, Jennifer Garner, I believe, was the protagonist. And I remember the review that came out, a scathing critical review in San Diego, and the review was three words, it's a girl. Meaning all they did was replace the boy with a girl and did the exact same story. To illustrate your point, they did nothing else with the role at all. It was simply a pure substitution.
Right. Now, with a lot of things, right, there's more engagement with the question, whether we're talking about women taking on roles that has historically been male roles in the real world versus in these fictional works. Right. It's one thing, I mean, we talk about this in the rabbinate too, as women have become rabbis. It's like, okay, are you essentially just, you can be a rabbi as long as you're an honorary man. As long as you don't do anything or act in a way that departs in any significant way from what we've come to expect, like the male rabbinic or leadership role to be. And now they're in a lot of different fields. There's this question of like, okay, well, what does it actually mean to bring in voices of people who had previously been marginalized? Maybe it actually changes our idea of what, you know, what the narrative is, or what, you know, the narrative arc could be, or what a leadership role looks like, or what the qualities are that we're looking for, as opposed to just kind of like, you know, making a minor tweak and otherwise the position, the story's the same. So I'm curious about that.
In my previous congregation, to take any of the honors during a Torah service, a woman would have to put on a tallis if she wasn't already wearing one. That was the norm of the community. And for some women, this really was exclusive and kept them away from participating fully in the life of the synagogue on Shabbat. My congregation here, which is more traditional, fully egalitarian, but there's no restrictions on what you must be wearing to take an aliyah out of the Torah. So if you wear a tallit, great. You don't wear a tallit, great. Head not covered, fine. Head covered, fine. It's actually more traditional in that it does not impose upon anyone in the room what they must be wearing. So I've come to actually prefer the more inclusive model of my current congregation over the more exclusive model of my previous one, though it is more progressive, but it's actually more exclusive. What's your take on that?
That's interesting. I mean, you know, I think about similar things. Right. I think in terms of how this question maps onto the conversation that we're having, there's an additional piece, which is, you know, to what degree tallit is being specifically identified as a male garment, and whether or not that is really true or socially true or feels true right now. And so I see the ways in which it could be exclusive. We've had an, or have confronted this, I feel like, more often in our shul because there have been a number of people who've joined. There were before too, other women who didn't wear a tallit, but there are a number of women who do not have the practice of wearing tallitot on Shabbat who take aliyot to the Torah, and they, we just have them use the girdle, the Torah binder. But it's something that I think about, like, should we actually change this practice? Because if you go to any Orthodox synagogue, where an Ashkenazi community where many men who are not married will not be wearing a tallit in the pews, if they come up to have an aliyah, what do? They put on a tallit.
Interesting.
So what's the principle here? Is the tallit a sign of respect for the Torah, regardless of whether one wears one all the time or not? Is there room for there to be difference in practice between people of different genders? There might be, but then that might vary depending on, a given community. And then if you have a mix of practices among people of a particular gender in a community, like, how do you understand that? It gets tricky.
The reason for the custom of men not wearing a large tallit in some European countries was financial, because they couldn't afford them. And therefore, they were given a pass. Okay, until you're married and working and earning money, you can just get away with wearing the undergarment tallit. And when you get married, then you can afford one, and then we're going to require that you have one at that stage in your life. That it was originally a financial concession, but not a.
Not like a you can't wear it.
Oh, but now it's become that. Now it's become like this: I'm single, I don't, and when I'm married, I will. It's become one of those things that now people embrace as divorce from the original reason for doing it.
Right. And then that makes sense then, why the custom developed of gifting a groom a tallit at the time of the wedding. Because you didn't have one before that, and it's
Did not
probably
have.
because it was expensive to have that much fabric, and then you get it, and it's so nice. Yeah, and now, I mean, it's become a different kind of thing, right? Where people might actually be self-conscious or develop self-consciousness around it because it then becomes an identifying marker of your marital status.
And back to your point about, the conservative movement basically telling women they had to become halakhically male to be a rabbi, which is still nominally the case. At least at JTS, our seminary. I know that Machon Schechter and the AJU have different standards about that. And certainly the left wing of Orthodoxy, women who become a Maharat or Rabbah or other newer titles, are not told that, which I really appreciate. Is that there's like a, well, of course, we're just going to be women as women in these roles as leaders, teachers, spiritual guides, etc. Without like shoehorning them into a role that they do not want to be in.
Right. Yeah, I think for me it's a little bit different. Like, I think I'm making somewhat of a distinction for me personally between halachic participation in mitzvot. Me, I'm like, okay, I don't think gender is like the relevant determining category about whether or not, you do mitzvot, Jews do mitzvot. It's more of like an imaginative thing to some degree to imagine, like, how might mitzvot look different if women or other people's voices had been incorporated more directly in the decision-making process of how we perform mitzvot. And how might they look differently now if we really embrace that? Or how might we think about different questions differently?
Do you mean, for example, like a question like, who is exempt from a mitzvah at any given time?
Right, maybe who's exempt from a mitzvah at any given time? What kinds of things we think of as being important events that might exempt one from a mitzvah and conversation around that, which is like happening now, but there aren't many satisfying answers around that. From the outset, if you're constructing a system, like, what does prayer look like depending on what your social reality is or your needs or your priorities? Then I also don't really want to get into a gender essentialist kind of set of views either, or sort of presume that, oh, because women have historically been more actively involved in raising and educating children, for example, that that should be like the predetermining factor for what women's halakhic practice looks like. But I think the reason the practice looks the way that it does is, you know, and Rabbi Ethan Tucker kind of says this, that women are adjuncts in society. You can only create a system that places the kinds of, you know, demands for regular performance of time-bound mitzvot if you have somebody else who's doing all the other stuff. What would it look like if you were creating a system from the ground up, that's like, okay, we have lots of different people who need to do, and collectively, we all need to get these kinds of things done. And we're trying to create meaningful religious practice. How do we incorporate the needs of like the spectrum of humanity that we have? And I just have to imagine that it would look different when you do that.
Right, the way that everything is distributed among everybody would look different if everyone is primary and nobody is, as he said, adjunct.
Right. If nobody is adjunct, then it's like, okay, so what becomes our way of distributing religious and other responsibilities? Or how do we think about religious responsibilities? Maybe we have a totally different framework for thinking about things. But now that we've been in this, the system that we have been in, and we're trying to figure out a way to modify it or incorporate people who had previously been in the adjunct role, things kind of butt up against each other, because if the more that you try to maintain the integrity of the system as it existed, that was based on a non-egalitarian model, there are things that are just going to be friction points becoming apparent. And we're talking about obligation. If you want to daven, then the way that you need to do that is you and your child's other parent just have to switch off, which involves just, okay, now you're just going to have to like do twice as many things in the same amount of time. So you were with the baby, you daven quick, probably with like zero kavanah. Now let's switch off and do the same thing. And so it just, this feeling of constantly running between one thing and the next was like the best option that was put forward, or you just get fatigued and opt out.
Right, because it's hard to do
Because
everything
it's
all
hard to do. For me, that was really difficult because I felt like I was, you know, a betraying Jewish feminism or my role as a rabbi or somebody who cared about being in the halachic community.
I'm excited to see where it goes. Those who don't care about how that system aren't going to change the system. But those who are
Right.
actively engaged in it, I'm curious to see where it's gonna, how it will evolve in the next iteration.
It's interesting, as you said, those who don't care about that system aren't going to change. I'm like, actually, like this made me think that within communities that are engaged with that system, we're going to see, you know, a much more active engagement with questions of egalitarianism that are not just in the religious sphere, because I see in so many communities and so many environments that we're still in this default setting that women are in charge of the kids and the house and all the other stuff. And if you're in a invested in a system where you care about religious participation, like that has implications for all of the other areas of life too. So you have to think about all of it. But if you don't care about the religious thing, you're like, oh, I'm fine just being, you know, in the kid room with the kids during services, I don't need to participate, then you're not challenging that part of like the default set of assumptions about gender roles either.
Interesting to contemplate the rethinking of all of that in those communities where all of that matters equally, where the whole thing is being reevaluated. Okay, have we come to the end of the main topic?
I think so.
We
I don't
certainly
know.
went to a different direction than we
Maybe in a
planned.
different direction than I
Yeah.
was necessarily anticipating.
As often happens with just
It's not.
associative thinking.
Yes.
Awesome.
Okay.
So from the Geniza, picks from the past of our favorite genres. What's your pick from the past?
Just like I always forget to even do this. Much like the Cairo Geniza, which was abandoned for
Yes.
hundreds of years.
Yes.
My brain did not think
That's okay. So
about this.
my brother encouraged me to watch the show Fringe, which began in 2008. So it's, 15, 16 years old. It's by J.J. Abrams and others. The creator of the show Lost. It definitely has a lot of Lost vibes. Also, because Michael Giacchino is the composer of the music for both. So it's actually a lot of the same weird music as well for like for particular moments, like the whole sliding down the strings and the brass for a weird moment. It has a lot of actually a lot of Jewish stuff going on in the show. For one, it has a lot of like Tower of Babel questions, like where is the line between what humanity should and shouldn't do is a perennial question in the show. Where is the line? Should we cross it or not? Where it begins to become hubris and dangerous. There is certainly in, and I don't want to, it's been like over a decade. Are there any spoilers left? I don't know. In season three, it's very clear that like a father has to sacrifice his son for the greater good. There is definitely a binding of Isaac moment. There's even the son bound in a machine with hands and feet shackles. So there really is a binding that happens there. It felt very much like the play out of the binding of Isaac happening. There's one episode in season two. There's a wedding. It is an intermarriage, which is important because half the family there is not Jewish, half is Jewish, and all the Jews die. And then the Jews die because there's this mysteriously unaging Nazi who's developing toxins to target certain people. So he is testing out his thing. Can I target just Jews? Can I target people with brown eyes, with brown hair? So he's trying very specifically targeted neurotoxins to kill people who aren't Aryan or the master race. So it's this weird, like, neo-Nazi bizarre science thing going on, but it begins in a Jewish wedding context. And I've already mentioned Olivia Dunham, the main protagonist, who is remarkable as a great protagonist in general. The show definitely has a lot of like those longer term Jewish things going on in it. Leonard Nimoy is in it for a couple seasons. Actually, one funny thing. So at some point, the character Nimoy plays is no longer part of the show, but his soul is still around. And so the actress playing Olivia Dunham has to do an impression of Leonard Nimoy because his soul is in her. So she does like a Nimoy impression for about half a season. It's pretty funny. It's a really good show. Definitely has, a lot of merit in general. And I've been enjoying, watching it, even though it's, I'm a bit late to the game.
Where does one go to watch it these
I
days?
am watching it on HBO Max. So no commercials, it's all there. It's five seasons and it's done. It didn't last longer than that. It did, I think it did actually get canceled in the end. They could have gone on. It also, just to say, it feels much more planned than Lost. They knew where they were going the whole time, not seat of the pants plot changes. So
Okay, so it does have a trajectory. So
it
it's the way
does. From the very beginning, it is going somewhere.
is this like X-Files where it's like a new story every.
Right. So it's kind of like a bit of X-Files, CSI, procedural crime drama with a weird fringy science twist and very long narrative arcs on top of that. Not so much character development, but long mystery arcs. Raise up some mysterious questions, answer a few, raise a few more questions, that kind of show. But you can watch an episode and still enjoy just that one episode's story. So episodic enough to dip in, watch one and dip out. But if you watch the whole thing, you could enjoy like the very long arc.
That's great. Another thing to add to the list.
Oh no, the list is so long.
The list is always so
The list
long.
is so long.
That concludes our 12th episode of Sacred Realms, from Sarah to Sarah Connor, heroines in Tanakh, sci-fi, and fantasy.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this conversation about sci-fi and fantasy through a Jewish lens and come back to hear more.
Our next episode will come out in about 1 month.
If you like the episode, please leave us a positive rating or review on the Apple Podcast app or wherever you prefer to find your podcast.
And thank you for all of our positive reviews and delightful emails so far. This episode was written and edited by me, Rabbi Lindsay Healy Pollack.
And me, Rabbi Andrew Pepperstone. We recorded on Zoom and edited using Descript.
And you can always reach us with questions, comments, and suggestions at sacredrealms@gmail.com.
May the Mefarshim be with you.